Welcome to the Against the Stream Nashville podcast. We're very excited to announce that we are changing our name to Wild Heart Meditation Center. You can stay subscribed to the podcast as you currently are, or if you choose to join us again at a later date in the future, just remember to search wherever you get your podcasts for Wild Heart Meditation Center. We're excited to be introducing new facilitators to our group and expanding our presence in our local community. Enjoy. So if you're coming for the first time tonight, I want to welcome you out. Our intention for the Sunday groups are to provide a little bit of an overview of different aspects of the Buddhist teachings. And the Buddhist teachings called the Dharma. Dharma just means something like truth or the way things are. And we're going to talk a little bit about this idea of what truth is from a Buddhist perspective tonight. And last week, if you were here, I talked a little bit about the myth and history of Buddhism. I shared the Buddha's story, the kind of mythological story of the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree and his experience of awakening. And then I also talked about, I'm very interested in some of the Buddhist scholars looking at like the time of the Buddha and what was happening in his culture to cause him to teach how he did. And I wanted to start by reiterating a couple of the themes and then share a little bit more about what the Buddha taught. But first I wanted to share a little bit about two principles that I talked about last time, how the Buddha taught. He taught, one of them is the principle of personal responsibility. And so during the time of the Buddha, something that's a little bit unique to his teaching is that he demoted the role of gods and he demoted the role of metaphysics in awakening, spiritual awakening. And so he promoted instead an idea that awakening, whatever that means, right, is a matter of ethical living and psychological training. And this was really important at the time of the Buddha because there were a lot of different spiritual paths. A lot of kind of ancient Indian, we would call this Vedic paths of practice. Different yogas, different concentration meditation, so many varieties. And really this was a commentary on a lot of things. But one of them is that spiritual awakening is not really all that spiritual from a Buddhist perspective. That he didn't say that gods or metaphysics didn't exist. And that's, I think, one of the things that sometimes we get a lot of folks that are exploring Buddhism because they're anti-dogma and they're anti-God. You know, the Buddha didn't say that there's no God, and he didn't say that there's no rebirth or things like that. He mostly didn't talk about them. When asked, he would most of the time just be silent. But what he did say, which was very clear, is when engaging in those conversations, he would always ask the people, well, what are you doing with your life today? How do you live? How do you communicate? Are you aware of your thoughts? Are you aware of your motivations and intentions behind things, right? He was really interested in what we can do, our personal responsibility. There's another principle that really drew me to Buddhism, where in Pali Sanskrit it's this word, ehipasiko, where the Buddha taught that all of his teachings were something of an invitation, not to be believed in, but to be taken on as a practice. And ehipasiko means come and see. So he was teaching really a system, which we're going to talk about tonight, of practices to apply to one's life, not for the purpose of believing in them, but for the purpose of investigation. So he taught personal responsibility and personal investigation, or self-reflection. He also taught another Pali Sanskrit word, opanayako, which means to be brought inside oneself. So when he taught the Dharma, he wasn't really looking at having any philosophical debates. This is why I don't agree with sometimes people say Buddhism's not a religion, but it's a philosophy. I don't really even think the Buddha was interested in philosophy or theology or any of that stuff. He was interested in psychology. He was interested in bringing awareness inside oneself and looking into our mind and seeing how we suffer in here. And the Buddha was a radical pragmatist in that way. And that's something that is important to share because it sets the stage for what he taught, which I'm going to talk about tonight. But I also feel like for me personally, it's something that drew me into this room, that made me feel comfortable enough to stay. And maybe it shows a little bit of my defiant personality type. But being told that I have to do the work if I want to heal or transform or recover, whatever word, awaken, whatever word we want to put in there, we've got to do the work. I've got to do the work for sure. And that no one's going to do it for me. That I can still have faith and I can still have aspiration for a greater good in the world, but that I've got to do the physical action, the practice. And that I can see for myself what works and what doesn't. The Buddha even famously says that if you see that any of my teachings or anyone's teachings, once applied in your life, don't lead to well-being, you should abandon them. And this is really cool. I remember hearing the Dalai Lama give a talk several years ago, and someone asked him, what happens if some of like Tibetan Buddhism starts to conflict with modern science? And he was like, oh, we definitely go with modern science. You know? And I like that, that invitation, that really the Buddha's instructions and teaching are scientific. They're to be run through empirical observation and tested. So if he says that awakening comes from ethical living and psychological training, and it comes from personal investigation and self-reflection, the next kind of question is, where do we get started? Or what do we practice? What the Buddha taught was a system of practice. It's what we refer to as the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. It's a system that encourages reflection on our own views and our intentions, a reflection on ethical living and what that looks like for us, a practice of diligent effort, and a deep practice of moment-to-moment awareness, investigation, and focus. So tonight I'm going to talk about the first noble truth, which is kind of like the first teaching, and then we'll have some discussion, some opportunity to share reflections or whatever comes up for you. The first noble truth, we would call it the truth of dukkha. Dukkha is D-U-K-K-H-A. And a lot of folks, when talking about the first noble truth, they won't translate the word dukkha because there's not really any close translation in English, which makes it kind of hard. But we'll try. The first thing I want to say is the truth, right? We usually capitalize the word T and we say, all right, this is like the good shit. I'm about to get the secret teaching. The Buddha's going to give me the truth of what life is about. Right? But from a Buddhist perspective, a truth is not so much something to believe in, it's a reflection to be undertaken and a task to be practiced. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. What is the reflection of dukkha and what is the task? What do we do with it? What does dukkha mean? That's the first thing. So the task is to reflect on it. And what it means is it gets its etymology from the root word du-akash. And that means basically a bumpy wheel. I like to think of dukkha as like the, I was at the Kroger today and like had the cart with the shitty wheel. You know, and that's what the Buddha is saying, is that life kind of has a shitty wheel to it. And it's mostly like you can navigate it, right? That's the good thing about in Buddhist metaphysics, because there are some, about taking a human birth, is that being a human, you can navigate a lot of things. You have conscious awareness, and you have volitional thoughts, you can direct your thoughts, you have some agency, right? But that life inherently is a little bit bumpy. There's some friction to it. And I want to read one of the teachers that I've sat with quite a bit. His name's Ajahn Sachido. He talks a little bit about it. I think he does a really good job. He said, everyone knows the feeling of lack or loss or conflict in their lives. This is what the Buddha called dukkha, often translated as suffering, but covering a whole range of meanings and nuances. At times, we feel a sense of need or dissatisfaction that can vary from mild weariness to utter despair. This feeling can be triggered either by a physical experience in our lives or by a mental or emotional experience concerning ourselves or other people. It's a feeling characterized by a sense that things are out of balance. Even if we are physically well and mentally skilled, we can feel disappointed that life isn't offering us enough, or that we're not making enough of it or doing enough, or that there's not enough time or enough space or enough freedom to do the things that we want to do. We can feel anxiety over the state of the planet and the environment. Anyone feel that way? Our perceptions of the present and the future are not secure and problem-free. So that pulls on us emotionally, that there's this sense of too much, feeling overwhelmed, not having enough space, time, and ease. In both cases, there's a continual sense of subtle or gross stress. Just reflect upon your activities and pursuits. Notice that they involve a constant effort to change or cope with what's disagreeable or to stimulate well-being. This striving is universal. So what the Buddha is asking us to reflect on, not so much believe in, is how is our life, or is our life, bumpy, disjointed, or stressful? And we can, I think most of us would say, well, yeah, duh, that's why I'm here. Some of us may be a little bit more reflective on that question itself. But the purpose is not to know this intellectually, right? It's to know directly and immediately this truth that life is bumpy, life is difficult. The first task that the Buddha is really encouraging us to do here is to not say, oh yeah, that's right, I agree, life is difficult. He's telling us to fully know, this word parinya in Pali Sanskrit, to fully know dukkha, to really sit down with it, to sit down with our dissatisfaction and our stress, and to turn our attention towards it. And this is very wild, right? They call the Buddha the rebel saint. This is very counter to some other spiritual and religious practices of our day. It's the first thing he taught. First truth, right out of the bag. Life is difficult. Fully know it. Comprehend it. Turn your attention to it. Look at it. So why would we want to do that, right? First, I want to talk a little bit about what did the Buddha define as dukkha? What does he say? Like, give me some examples. All right, life is disjointed, it's difficult, but what are some examples? He said, very plainly, he said, this is dukkha. Birth is dukkha. Aging is dukkha. Sickness is dukkha. Death is dukkha. Encountering what is not dear to you is dukkha. Separation from what is dear to you is dukkha. Not getting what one wants, dukkha. And this last part may not make much sense if you're new to Buddhism. He says, in short, clinging to the five aggregates as self is dukkha. So I like to look at this word as just like being alive means we're vulnerable. And I even like, I sometimes share the etymology of the word vulnerability in Latin means susceptibility to woundedness. Right? That just by being born in this world, we're susceptible to aging, sickness, and death. Like, that's an inevitable aspect of our existence, and we can talk about it intellectually. We can know, oh yeah, definitely. But let's not think about it. Why think about that? That's morose, that's morbid, that's not something, right? that we want to constantly reflect on. So why do we want to practice this? It's because when we live outside of reality, we suffer. When we forget that this is the way that our humanity is, we suffer. What do we normally do in the face of getting what we don't want or being separated from what we do want is we resist or we distract. When we experience grief or loss or tragedy in our lives, we resist or we distract. And this is the second truth, which we'll talk about more next week, is that when we are vulnerable, because we are vulnerable, we try to control our experiences and circumstances to make it not so. We argue with reality. Byron Katie says, I don't practice spiritual practice because I'm a spiritual person, but because it hurts like hell to argue with reality. And this is really what the Buddha's saying, is just, it's going to hurt like hell to argue with this reality. So what if we turn towards it and practice working with it? And what does it mean? What would it mean to work with our vulnerability, with loss and death and grief? And really, the first step is to be honest that it's a fucking thing. Societally, I think we really all cover up this reality. And my wife and I are trying to get pregnant right now, and you know, I'm entering this world of how difficult, right, even getting pregnant is, and all of the dukkha that comes with that. My friend today just, I check in with him every week, he just messaged me and said that his wife had an early stage miscarriage, and I'm being included now in a world of experiences that I, as a 13-year-old boy, didn't think about that much. You know, a world of dukkha. And so how can we start to just be real about this and share about that and be like, oh, that's actually something that happens a lot. And being human is really hard a lot of the time, that we do grieve. I just had a client of mine pass the other day, and she killed herself. And this is someone that I've been working with closely for a year. And nothing prepares us for that experience. You know, and all of the emotions, like all of the reality of like what it means to have someone that was here not be here all of a sudden. Like, do I really know that? No. I know it when it happens, but do I really know that experience? And so we want to be able to talk about these things. I think that's really the first thing the Buddha is saying, is like, can we please at least talk about this? Can we please at least talk about like what's hard about being human? Ajahn Chah says, people have suffered in one place, so they go somewhere else. When they've suffered there, they run off again. They think they're running away from suffering, but they're not. It goes with them. They carry suffering around without knowing it. He says, if you don't know suffering, you can't know the cause of it. And if you don't know the cause of suffering, then you can't know its release. And so what causes suffering is that we argue with this, right? What causes suffering is that we resist and distract ourselves from what's difficult. And it's a very trippy thing. I don't even know. This is interesting to me because I've been teaching for probably 4.5, 5 years now. And this is still one of the most difficult teachings to give. And it's the most rudimentary. Like, you got to, as a Buddhist teacher, you've got to be able to give a talk on the First Noble Truth. But it's the hardest because there's something in this. Like, how is it that by turning towards the disturbances in our life, the distress in our lives, that we actually free ourselves from them? I don't know. We'll talk about it later. But there's something around what he's saying, is that we do suffer more when we run, right? We do definitely know that. When we avoid or we distract, we suffer more. And so instead, when the task at hand is to fully know, it's to understand dukkha And it's to embrace. It's to embrace our vulnerability. And when I first heard this teaching, my teacher Dave started Against the Stream Nashville 8-9 years ago, and this is really what sold me, and it was a really weird experience. It's something about hearing the Buddha, this 2,600-year-old teaching, normalize human suffering for me in a time and place in my life where I was suffering tremendously with depression, no motivation, barely being able to get out of bed, hopeless. Went into the meditation group, and the Buddha was like, yeah, you're definitely going to suffer. Totally happens to everyone. And there was something about like that not being unique and being shared and being this 2,600-year-old teaching, that's really the foundation of the Buddhist teaching, that I was like, I'm in. I totally, first truth, check that one off. I'm down. Right? Now, where's the third truth, which is the release from suffering? And this first step, of course, is to be honest. Like I was talking about, you know, I even see this in the mental health field, the stigma of mental health. And it baffles me sometimes. I forget, because I think we're getting better culturally. I really do. I could be wrong, but I feel like much more today than ever, people are willing to seek therapy and to take, you know, psychotropic medication, see a med provider. I feel like much more today than ever, but I still, every once in a while, I get met with, I'll have a client and I forget, like a new client, and they're just like so guarded. And I'm like, what's up, dude? You're paying me to talk to me and you're all guarded and shit. Like, stop. Talk to me. You know, you're paying me like good money. And I almost like, it's frustrating. And then I realized it's like, oh yeah, it's really hard to break that stigma that like that's weak or that's, or the trust, right? And all the wounds that come around that. I always like to say that as a mental health practitioner that I don't believe in disorders. Right? I think we need to talk about disorders from the Western medical model. It's good because it's what we know, kind of like they actually talk about them as clusters. They're like traits that happen. You know, but I never seen an ordered person in my life. Never once. I've never met a single ordered person. Usually people that think they're ordered kind of fucked up, right? So there's again this kind of stigma that there's order and there's disorder, there's normal and there's abnormal. And how much of our suffering is created around trying to get the normal life? We joke, of course, the American dream, the white picket fence, the house, two kids, a dog, whatever, right? But we all have our varieties of that story, the normal. You ever tell yourself, I'm 43 years old, I'm not supposed to be doing this. I should have, right? There's this kind of like weird dukkha that comes with aging. And I'm young, but I even see it. It's like, man, I'm really supposed to, like, if I look at everyone else my age, I should be able to be doing some of the things they're doing. So there's that kind of, that story. And we got to be honest. We got to be honest about the ways that we suffer. I really love this quote. I saw it pop up on my timeline recently, and I figured I'd pull it for this group. It's by Carl Jung. He uses male pronouns, and I tried to switch them out, but it was too confusing, so forgive me. He said, "If you imagine someone who is brave enough to withdraw all his projections, then you get an individual who is conscious of a pretty thick shadow. Such a man has saddled himself with new problems and conflicts. He has become a serious problem to himself, and he is now unable to say that they do this or that. They are wrong. They must be fought against. Such a man knows that whatever is wrong in the world is in himself, and if he only learns to deal with his own shadow, he has done something real for the world. He has succeeded in shouldering at least an infinitesimal part of the gigantic, unsolved social problems of our day." And this is so timely for me, is that my mind, my heart rushes out into the world as a social worker, right? To like act and to engage, to like bear in mind this message. And it's just a part, like it's not the whole picture, but being able to, as he says, be brave enough to withdraw all our projections and to turn our attention to our own dukkha. And to know that whatever is wrong in the world is wrong in ourselves. Greed, hatred, and delusion, if we're talking about it from a Buddhist perspective. Why is there greed in the world? Why is there hatred in the world? Why is there delusion in the world? Because it's in the mind. Because we think that getting the thing is going to solve the problem. Or we think that fighting each other, violence, conquering and colonizing and oppressing and is going to solve the problem. We have this delusion that we're different, that there are differences in our suffering. That I have a unique set of suffering and yours is different. Mine's worse. And so why do we do this? Because this is in our minds, all of us. We all have our inner politicians. Right? I won't say names. But we all have our inner politicians. Whatever ones you don't like, for real, doesn't matter. The politicians you don't like, you got their same suffering. Right? And so I like this as a part of just an exercise. Am I willing to look at my own suffering? Am I willing to look non-judgmentally, not with this harsh, like, puritanical right or wrong, but really like deeply look into my own mind, into my own suffering. In Buddhism, disturbance is the path. It is what we're working with. During meditation, when the mind wanders, that's why we meditate, is to be kind to the mind that wanders. When the mind says, you're a loser and you're never going to do it, to notice the mind that's unworthy, that's a shame, to notice the mind that's harsh, judgmental, critical, cynical, doubting, and to bring that as the meditation object and to say, I'm so sorry. I care about you. I forgive you. I'm not you. You're just a thought. It's not personal. You're conditioned. You've been taught that. And I'm sorry that you've been taught that. It's not true. And there's so much power in being able to recognize that disturbance is the path. It's what we're working with. There's a transformation that happens when we don't try to fix our pain, but we instead give it space and try to understand it. And this is the part I was talking about earlier that is hard to explain. There's something about our system, our brain, our heart, the mind, the body, that's organically intelligent, that knows how to heal itself. And I think if anything, like to get really rudimentary and simple, all the Buddha did to transform his life is sit down. And there's something about all this running around that I do in my day-to-day life that is not solving the problem. I'm putting out a lot of fires. I'm accumulating wealth and I'm making connections and shit. And that's great. Like the Buddha said, my teaching doesn't require you to abandon any of your worldly pleasures. He says just your attachment to them. So we want to know that, yeah, the mind, the body, it heals itself. We just got to sit down, take time to open, not to fix our pain, but to try to sit with it. And this is the first step, really. Maya Angelou said that courage is the most of all the virtues, because without courage, you cannot practice any other virtue consistently. You can be anything erratically, kind, true, generous, fair, merciful, or just. You can be any of those things occasionally, but to be that thing time after time demands that you have courage. And so there's this something about this courage to sit down, and courage has the Latin origin of the heart. Just being able to sit and to feel our pain demands that we have courage. There are two parts of compassion. Compassion is learning how to feel and to know our pain, to listen to it, to listen deeply to it, and to wish for it to be free. And to not maybe even have the answer of, like, what am I going to do? Like, what's the thing or the plan that's going to fix me? But instead, just be like, I am so sorry. I wish... You know when friends say that, they're like, I'm so sorry. I wish that wasn't happening right now. It's kind of sucks, but it's kind of great, because it's like, that's all you can really say. You know how you don't know what to say when someone's in pain? Like, that's pretty much what compassion is. It's like, oh my God, I'm sure that is, like, devastating, and I wish that wasn't happening to you right now. And it totally changes things, and like, and how can I fix it? And how can I make your sadness go away so I don't have to be uncomfortable with it? Right? And of course, none of us are experts at this. It's a practice. Compassion means understanding, listening, hearing, feeling, and wishing. The Buddha has this aspiration. There's something called the Metta Sutta. I won't read it tonight. It's a little bit lengthy, but you should read it. It's really good. And it has a lot of these, like, high bars or this aspiration for freedom. And he says things like, let no being deceive another, nor despise any other being in any state of mind. He said, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be free. All beings. He says, whatever beings there may be. And he goes and he fucking lists them. He's like, whether they're small or tall or big or short or, you know, like in the sea or on the land or whatever. He's like, born and unborn. He's like, includes everyone. And this is the aspiration of compassion, is may we all be free from suffering. May we learn how to sit quietly with our pain, to share our pain, to care for our pain, so we don't have to keep making it. And, you know, easier said than done, but it can be done. And that's what we're here doing. Right? And sometimes it's like, I'm sitting here, I've been on several meditation retreats, and like in the middle of a month-long meditation retreat, I'll literally be like, I have no clue why I'm here. I'll just be like, I've been here in Burma for 2 weeks and I have no clue what I'm doing here anymore. Right? And that's the purpose of a Dharma talk, is to remind us, you know, like, why are we here? Well, we're here because it's really hard for a lot of us. If we were to really know what each one of us' personal, unique life experiences have been, like if we were to have 72 hours to play, like, I don't know, an hour clip of our lives. You know, there's connection in that. And that's why we're here. We're here to connect, we're here to care, we're here to understand. So I don't know. That's what I got. Some thoughts. We want to open it up to hear from y'all. Questions, comments, thoughts that you may have. We kind of have an open sharing format. The only thing that we ask